have an agenda?
I don't have an agenda.
Well, Dan, you're here to testify on 574?
Yes.
Right. And you wanted to testify first because you have another commitment at this time?
The same bill for consideration of House Judiciary at the same time.
I see.
I think that's it.
Yeah, that is it. Thank you.
Plus, I believe another man is there.
All right. We'll call the meeting to order. Do we have the present for the purposes of quorum are Senators Rohde, Ziegler, and Holman. Before the committee for discussion is Senate Bill 574, a special appropriation to the Alaska court system.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Dan Hickey. I'm the chief prosecutor of the state. Senate Bill 574 is a bill which is designed to respond to the fact that in October of last year, during the municipal election in Anchorage, municipal police services were extended to the Sand Lake, Muldoon, Eagle River areas. As I understand it, as a result of that, the Anchorage Police Department has, in January, added 10 new commissioned officers. They planned to add 51 new officers effective July 1 of 78 and an additional 24 effective April 1st of 1979. Now, that'll represent a total increase of something like 85 officers over 1977 levels. In the Department of Law budget this year, there was a request for one additional position that was partially predicated on the impact that we anticipated from this increase in law enforcement personnel in Anchorage. At the time, the administration's budget was put together, which was in the mid to late fall. The election had just happened. We didn't have a schedule from the Anchorage Police Department as to how rapidly they were going to add personnel or exactly how many were going to be involved. In addition, the Department of Public Safety had not had an opportunity to evaluate what they were going to do in the Anchorage area. I think we've since had a number of meetings and been able to get a little better picture of what's going on there. I have a copy of the report that the court system prepared, which, as I understand it, constitutes some kind of a backup paper for Senate Bill 574. And it contains as an appendix a letter from Anchorage Chief of Police Charles Anderson, which I think is probably the best indicator of what we could anticipate at this point in time in terms of impact. We, again, this morning had a meeting in the governor's office between myself, Mr. Dawson, and Mr. Harper, and the people from the Division of Budget Management on this question. And the administration's position on this is essentially as follows. There's no question that there's going to be some impact as a result of the addition of that many new officers in the Anchorage area. It's really difficult to predict what that impact is going to be like. It's going to depend on a lot of intangibles, such as whether the Anchorage Police Department really can get that many officers recruited and trained and online that quickly. What kind of officers they're going to be, in other words, how carefully they're going to be screened, how carefully they're going to be trained, that sort of thing. I noticed that in the paper that was put together, based on, again, Chief Anderson's letter, basically a straight line approach has been taken to predicting the increase in caseload. That's probably as valid a way as valid an approach as could be taken to the subject at this point in time without delving into some of those intangibles. although it assumes a couple of things. It assumes, for example, that there are, in effect, in those areas, an infinite number of crimes, that it's simply a matter of adding new officers, and therefore, for every new officer you get, you pick up an equivalent number of arrests to the number of arrests that are currently being made by officers presently working. I don't know whether that's a valid assumption or not. I don't think anyone does, and there's probably no way to really test for it. In discussing the subject with both Mr. Snowden and Mr. Barrier from the court system, I think a couple of things are clear here. One is that the figures you have before you in Senate Bill 574 contemplate the addition of personnel both within the court system, within the district attorney's office in Anchorage, and within the public defender in Anchorage, commencing July 1. I frankly think that a good deal of that could be delayed until January 1. That would give us a much better handle on the kind of impact we're realizing, what we're going to need, etc. There are some things in here that however, can't be delayed. For example, within the public defender category, there is a block of money that, as I understand, is allocated for office space. They're presently located in the court building in Anchorage. Mr. Barrier can, I think, address himself to this more specifically, but I can tell you from our office's point of view, for example, that the space situation in that the older court building for non-court system offices has simply become a substantial problem. I now have our office situation located in two different places there on the criminal side, and a portion of the criminal division in Anchorage is in office space that will no longer be available July 1. And the public defender is sort of in an equivalent situation. And as a result of, I think, some of this expansion, which is going to be necessary, some additional space requirements are going to have to be addressed effective July 1. Now, another thing that's happened here, as I understand it, is that for example, in my budget, this position I described previously was requested by the governor. It was disallowed in the House, and in discussing with staff from the Division of Legislative Finance, I understand that it was disallowed because of the fact that this bill was submitted, and that to some extent there was a perception that one position duplicated positions that were requested through this bill. That's probably partially correct. At present, in Anchorage, we are carrying an active caseload of 398 misdemeanor cases and 182 felony cases in the DA's office, plus a substantial appellate caseload both in the office and in our appeals unit there, and an additional caseload of all white-collar cases. That basically breaks out at present to 67 misdemeanor cases per misdemeanor attorney and 37 felony cases per felony attorney. Given those caseloads, we need another position in Anchorage right now as it is. We particularly need one in the face of additional impact that of any kind that would be realized as a result of additional law enforcement officers being added. So from my perspective, it's essential that the legislature restore the position either through the vehicle of this bill or through the vehicle of regular budget.
Could you
contemplate?
I may be asking you to repeat yourself, but could you identify that position again?
The position was an attorney for position in Anchorage that was deleted. It was the only item in our budget deleted by the House.
Thank you.
And my understanding is it was deleted because this bill exists. So the questions are sort of tied together. Now, I believe that the total cost on this bill is about $1.3 million. And without reducing it to specifics, I think that the total could be brought down to around $900,000 if, for example, the one position that I'm talking about was restored in Anchorage for the district attorney's office. One position was funded here for the Public Defender Agency as secretary and the space. One of the judges was added effective July 1, and the other positions were only authorized to commence January 1. And perhaps even one or two of those could be authorized to commence April 1st of 1979, which would, in other words, it'd be sort of a staggered approach to the plans. And I think that's the approach I'd like to propose to the committee. There's no question here that the system is going to be substantially impacted by what happened last fall. The other thing that isn't addressed here is the potential impact on the Department of Public Safety and the Division of Corrections. Now, more cases being made by the Anchorage Police Department, strangely enough, is going to impact the Department of Public Safety. It's going to impact them in the area of judicial services. In other words, their civil service section, who are responsible for transporting prisoners, for executing warrants, for serving summons and subpoenas, that sort of thing. It's definitely going to impact the Division of Corrections, who, on a contractual relationship with the city, run the Anchorage Annex, which is basically the main pretrial detention facility in the Anchorage area. The facility, for example, belongs to the city. We lease it, and in return, we house city prisoners there who are both charged under state statute and under city ordinance. So those are two variables that are not addressed by the bill, and I think they need to be. Other than that, I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Hickey?
Senator Ziegler? Just down one. How much of the total money sought is attributable, sought by the state is attributable to the increase in the Anchorage Police Department?
How much of the money that's sought in our regular budget is?
Well, that's right. In other words, you're asking for more money for this district attorney or that office or what have you. How much of the additional expense is attributable to the increase in the number of policemen contemplated to be or on the Anchorage Police Force?
In this bill or in our budget?
In this bill.
In this bill. The total that's in this bill for the Department of Law is $169,000, the bulk of which is in personal services. That's for three attorneys, one secretary, and one clerk typist. Those are figures that were submitted, as I understand it, by the court system as a result of getting preliminary estimates from Joe Balfour, the district attorney in Anchorage. What's really difficult, Senator, to separate out is how much of that is attributable to just the Anchorage Police Department and how much of it is attributable to funding new judges. Okay? If no additional judges are funded, obviously we're going to be impacted much less severely than if not only does the police department add personnel, but the judges add additional positions. It seems to me, and I've thought about this, it's a very difficult thing to try and reduce to figures, but I think that one judge probably impacts us about as much as 30 new officers. So I think that without any new judges, the position I requested in our regular budget is adequate for the initial impact we perceive from the additional officers added by the Anchorage Police Department. That cost is approximately $57,000, to answer your question specifically. If, however, additional judges are added as a result of this bill, the fact that additional judges are there calendaring cases, particularly given the current calendaring system combined with our policy with respect to plea negotiations, then that additional position becomes insufficient. So you got to ask yourself, I think with respect to both my office and the Public Defender Agency, to what extent are positions needed simply as a result of the addition of police officers, and to what extent are they needed as a result of additional judges, which might be added because of perceived impact from from additional police officers. Is that, I hope I'm not being obtuse.
No, no, you're fine. You're fine.
Other questions of Mr. Hickey?
One question, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that this appropriation is the direct result of expanding the police protection areas in Anchorage, and that if you look at it as a rational law enforcement measure, that if you do expand the police protection areas, you have to have more local police to handle it, and that the request for the police powers to be given to the two areas in Anchorage is a result of the fact that it's probably not being adequately taken care of now.
But by the state trooper?
Yes.
Let me say that right now the state troopers police those same three areas, Sand Lake, Multnomah, and Eagle River, with 31 officers. The Anchorage Police Department proposes to police those areas with 75 officers. More than double.
Is there any indication that this is necessary?
Well,
I that's not a very fair question to ask you. I understand, but why is there a disparity? Perhaps that's a better question.
Why is there a disparity? Well, the I'm in sort of the enforcement position of having to speak for someone else, I think, on this question. And I guess I'd want to make that clear. I've discussed it with both Commissioner Burton and Chief Anderson. Commissioner Burton, I mean, believes that he is and has been understaffed in those areas. No question about that. And Chief Anderson says that looking at it rationally and objectively, this is a minimum of what we need to do an adequate job providing 24-hour police protection in those three areas.
Senator Ziegler?
Yeah. Well, what you're saying is the municipality of Anchorage takes over the operation. It's going to have roughly, or going to have, twice as many law enforcement people doing what the lesser number did.
Right.
Okay. Is the lesser number, the 31 state troopers, or are they going to be released for duty elsewhere, or are they going to be there too, making a grand total of 90-something?
That's an excellent question. Glad you raised it. My understanding of what's going to happen there is that they are not going to be transferred elsewhere. They're going to remain in the Anchorage area, and that it's going to that in terms of the impact that would be placed on the adjudication system, district attorney, court, public defender, from that would be basically as a result of the following things. Number one, it's going to enable the Division of State Troopers to place more emphasis on major crimes in those same areas, okay, that they cannot now place as a result of patrol responsibilities. That it's also going to enable them to place increased emphasis on homicide investigations throughout the Anchorage metropolitan area. As I understand it, that when these 75 officers are online, or at least when the 51 are online in July, that the city of Anchorage and the state troopers will combine to form a special metro homicide team, sort of modeled after the present metro drug operation. It's going to enable the troopers to increase their level of investigatory capability in the area of white-collar crime, which is very badly needed, but which will have a large impact on us because it requires the attention of a prosecuting attorney in the investigative phase of the development of a case if you're not going to result in the wasting of a lot of law enforcement effort. Plus, the cases that are made are generally quite involved, quite lengthy, and quite complicated. They involve lots of documents, that sort of thing. It's also, as I understand it from discussions with the Department of Public Safety, going to result in the assignment of special troopers to the international airport, with emphasis on drug investigations. The last thing it's going to enable them to do is to concentrate patrol personnel on state highways, the Seward Highway in particular, for example, which is going to result in an increase in traffic-related offenses that are brought into the system. The other thing the troopers are doing, which is sort of separate and apart from both their ability to sort of reallocate personnel and the APD's addition of new officers, is that right around the same time, July 1st, they will be putting 5 additional troopers on the road as part of a special traffic team with emphasis on ONVI enforcement. As a result of a grant from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which means that in effect what you're going to have, to answer Senator Ziegler's question, is 75 new officers plus the 31 troopers reallocated plus 5 more troopers. So we're really looking at really an additional increase in terms of the case development capability of the Department of Public Safety in the Anchorage area. Well, one of the other reasons, by the way, Mr. Chairman, that I suggest breaking the figures down here to allow for some positions, to authorize some positions not until January, is that, for example, with the judge, let's say that the legislature finds it appropriate to authorize the creation of a new district judge July 1. There's a 30-day minimum period where applications are going to be solicited. There's another minimum of 2 weeks where the Judicial Council is going to be interviewing applicants and deciding on the selection of nominees to submit to the governor. The governor then has 45 days to make an appointment, which really means that if you authorize a judge for July 1, and it's not authorized until sometime, say, early June, that it's going to be next to impossible to get a judge there on the bench working much before October. So there's going to be a lag period here anyway, which means that, and as I understand these figures contemplate a full fiscal year funding.
Senator Sidman.
One more question for you, Dan. I really have mixed emotions about this. If we apply what you just told us to another community in the state of Alaska, let us arbitrarily say Fairbanks, and let's say that Fairbanks goes out and hires an additional 30 patrolmen. Wouldn't that, what you've just said, be equally applicable here, perhaps not in the same numbers, but as a justification for hiring another public defender, another DA, or the creation of a new court, the increase in the size of the number of policemen?
No question about it, sir.
Juneau, Ketchikan, same thing?
You're absolutely correct. Any place in the state where the citizenry decide that the level of police protection they have at present is unacceptable and authorize the expansion of police personnel in that area is going to impact the entire criminal justice system in the state.
Well, I have a problem with it because this is an Anchorage bill, pure and simple, and the citizens in Bethel per capita are going to be paying just as much to improve the situation in Anchorage as the citizens in Anchorage are in terms of taxpayer dollars. And I'm not so sure I like the concept.
The situation, of course, that the system will be faced with, say, my office, to begin with, is that these, come July 1, assume there are 51 police officers out there who are ready, willing, and able to make new cases. They come in. I have to have some kind of policy direction from somewhere as to what should be done with those cases. Right now, under state law, anyone who's arrested or charged or referred to our office under a state offense is prosecuted by our office. We have done everything we can, and I should say in fairness to Anchorage, for example, that in the last 2 years they have done a substantial job in picking up prosecutions for minor misdemeanor offenses under their local ordinances, better than any municipality in the state. And we're encouraging them to do that, and we will continue to do so. But there are offenses that are only offenses as a result of state law, and of course a municipality cannot make an offense a felony under ordinance. So anything that's a felony or a serious misdemeanor is going to come to our office, and the people of Anchorage or the people of Fairbanks or the people of whatever community we're talking about, expect that those cases are going to be processed, that people are going to be charged, and that they're going to be tried.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rohde.
In response to Senator Ziegler's comment, I think that each individual community has the right to set the level of law enforcement which they feel is appropriate, given the statutes of the state and other state functions. And in this case, some areas of Anchorage have said that they wish a higher level of police protection for a variety of reasons. And they're paying the bill for the policemen, and I can assure you it's many millions of dollars. And it is going to impact the state, so I would ask for the concern of the committee, because these people do wish a higher level of police protection, and it surely will impact the state, because it will be required to provide more prosecutorial help, as well as greater funding for the court system. Anchorage, on a per capita basis, has been strapped in terms of its district attorney's office. They've done an admirable job. I would like to see them have a few more people there. And I think that this is one of those measures that is a response to a local decision, and would hope the committee would support it.
Senator Tillian.
How far does it have to go before your police saturation actually puts a adverse curve on your crime level? I know I'm familiar with one community at least, where they finally got so many cops that the crime level is exceedingly low. You got a few enclaves, but nobody pulls anything big because there's a cop almost at every block. At what point is that? They did it in Washington, D.C. Just absolutely put enough cops on to where it's safe again. I go there frequently enough to know that you can now walk where you never walked before. So what I'm wondering about, how far you have to go before your crime statistics do the other switch. I know there's a point there.
Sure.
And maybe not in white collar crime. If you just spread your police into some new crime field, why, yes, you can keep up.
Sure, street crime, you're absolutely correct. That obviously, that point is going to vary from one case to another.
This is an awful lot to ask without coming into the budget through the screening process.
Well, don't misunderstand me, Senator. I didn't mean to convey to the committee that this is an administration request. This is not an administration request. This bill was, my understanding of this bill is that it was a bill that was put together in a sort of cooperative effort under the sponsorship of the administrative director of the court system, and was introduced as a courtesy to the court system by the two respective judiciary committees. And I could be mistaken about that.
Yeah, but why wasn't it part of the court system budget so the court system could request it? The governor never cuts the court system budget. He just puts it over for us to look at. This one has quasi-blessings from a lot of people, but it doesn't have the absolute stamp of the court system. They're dodging whose it is.
We raised that question with them. I think they're in probably a better position to respond to that. Mr. Greger's here, and I'm sure he'll like to when he gets on the hot seat, so to speak.
Okay, I'm ready for him.
Are there questions of Mr. Higgy?
Very careful presentation, considering what he had to work with.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, sir.
You too.
Running an extra through this knot there.
Did you wish to testify in this?
You better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is the court system bill?
Yes, it is.
why wasn't it part of your budget? Or wait, I didn't even get sworn.
You promised to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and then you may answer his question. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Richard Berry, I'm the deputy director of the bus support system. And is this on the road? No. We ended up last week with House Judiciary, and considerably in our investigation. So far, I don't think I've told the legislature any lies, so. Yes, it is a court system generated bill. The history of it is that last fall, as Dan said, in October, when the election was, we knew there would be judicial service areas taken over by the city. And we're aware that there would be a sizable impact on the court. But Dan has commented on this on budget. At that time, he didn't have an idea. The city really had no firm idea how many people and where they would be and when they'd come on. So we checked it out and no one had firm plans. We said, well, rather than put in our budget, it's a bunch of positions or judges to wait until after January when the budget was passed to see what they actually were for the budget process and to try to firm it up to where it was a little more accurate statement. Also, we felt that the impact is a system impact. It's not an impact strictly on the court. It certainly impacts the public defender and the district attorney. And that saying that as a basically omnibus or unified bill of both branches of the government, that it would give the legislature a better feeling for exactly what Senator Ziegler was talking about. This is an impact from the decision the city has made and should be treated as this type of impact. We were not, we're not trying to circumvent any particular budget process, but rather than coming as a supplemental addition onto our regular operating budget, we felt that having all agencies together in one bill and treating them as a separate issue was a clearer way for the legislature to deal with it. We discussed it with the governor's office, and at that time, I think even Mr. Hickey was somewhat opposed to the whole concept. We've done a considerable amount of work on it in the last 2 or 3 months trying to figure out just what's going to happen. And I think even he now is, you know, as he pointed out, there's several things that evolve around here that are going to be impacting on him. And he's concerned too now. But at that time, we asked the governor himself to, or the office to introduce it. And their opinion was, well, let's wait and see what happens. Our opinion is that certainly for the court system, the impact is going to be of such significance that you wait and see until next April for a supplemental or whatever. That, given the volume of cases, seeing that this is primarily district court misdemeanor type cases, that if we're not prepared for it, that in 10 months or 8 months of operation, we can have nearly 10 or 20 or 30,000 cases sitting there waiting to process. Because there's such a mill of cases that you slack off and don't have the judicial personnel to process it, then they're in trouble. I guess I should comment also on the timing issue. Mr. Hickey stated that he's not sure what the timing of the impact will be. In our meetings with Chief Anderson, he stated that and it's a fact that as of today, at least one, and I believe another academy worth of city police have come through the Secret Academy or in the process of being trained there. And on July 1, he says, anyway, I have to believe him, that his intention is to have this 51 people out on the street working on that day, not in training or being recruited. And that's another thing that somewhat, I think, sort of scared us. And he said, well, we're going to start training, bring the people on in some kind of phased-in process. I think we probably could have absorbed this and held off maybe the next year on supplemental. But if he has 51 more people out there July 1, they're going to be arresting people and bringing them in to be arraigned, bail set, and all that. Somebody has to arraign them, and somebody has to handle the paperwork. And that was our concern. I thought we could do some planning and avoid a major crunch in this area. But, it's obviously
a controversial way of doing it. Not a controversial issue.
But I still feel like it has at least brought the issue really to a legislature to consider. As Dan was saying, if you'd like to go back to the operating budgets or in a fee conference or do something with the operating budgets, the vehicle by which whatever impact is funded is really immaterial. But we thought it would be just for the legislature to review this impact in a single package.
Now, it's $1.25 million, and I don't like the court system pointing to us as being added with the bill. I like them to come forward and eat it all by themselves.
Well, we don't object to coming forward and acknowledging it's our bill.
In effect, then, it's a supplemental to the
supplemental in advance.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Derrick?
No questions, Chairman. I'd like to just make a comment. I think it's entirely proper to have it in this bill form because the question is Senator Ziegler very well. Is the question of whether a local community wishes to undertake greater law enforcement will receive the aid and assistance of the state. And all the costs are in one bill. All the impact is in one bill, and it's appropriate for the legislature to make that type of decision. It's quite that simple. Rather than have it hidden in the budget, or have it tucked away someplace else, or have it done piecemeal, this is the desirable way to do legislation. It is in the appropriate committee for consideration. I think this is the best possible method of handling this sort of thing. And we just have a policy decision to make.
Further comments? Question, do you know what the office space, what you pay for office space in Bethel from that new building?
$1.95.
That includes janitorial. Yeah.
It's a good lease. They want to lease the space, and they worked out a great agreement.
No further questions. Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill, Senate Bill 574? If not, we'll go to Senate Joint Resolution 44. Proposed amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska increasing membership of each chamber of the legislature.
Could you call 33?
Senator Croft?
70 from here. You mean you closed that budget as soon as I was gone?
Well, it turned out about 3:15. There were some people waiting to see the budget, so we closed more than that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This increases the membership of the legislature, the Senate from 20 to 25, the House from 40 to 51. The purpose of the amendment is threefold. One, it recognizes the fact that there has been a substantial increase in population in the state. There has been no change in the size of the legislature since David. Overall, it would tend to keep a more close approximation of the per capita representation figure as it originally envisioned by the framers of the Constitution, even though the state population has gone up much more than it indicates the size of the legislature. Secondly, it recognizes that barring a major population shift that nobody feels is likely, that southeastern and western Alaska will lose representation after the 1980 reapportionment. Nothing that we can do about that under the one man, one vote decision, the Baker versus Carr, some other decision of the United States Supreme Court, but we can keep the same number of representatives, and thus the people's access to their representatives by passing this resolution. It's my feeling that this would mean that neither southeastern nor western Alaska would lose either representatives or senators as a result of the 1980 reapportionment, even though their proportionate representation in the House might be reduced. Third, it does
provide for an odd number of both Senate and House members. It does break ties. There have been organizational delays in the past as long as a week as a result of having an even number of legislators on the body. It has been supported, I think, by at least a sort of comment that I've seen on it that supported the resolution of the South Central, Southeastern Democrat. That's the resolution of course.
Questions of Senator Croft?
I have ambivalent feelings about this resolution. In many ways I like it, in other ways I wonder about it.
It opens a Pandora's box for a steadily increasing legislature, and I've seen some of the other legislative bodies that, have 100 and some members in the House.
Or 400 or whatever.
Yeah, New Hampshire.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, the problem is, and I've talked with Senator Croft about this, so he knows the problem that I have with it is this. By and large, I think the average citizen in this state, certainly the average voter, figures that 60 of those orangutans are enough, and they could care less about increasing the number in Anchorage and making Southeastern and Southwestern or wherever remain constant in terms of numerical representation. So actually, from my viewpoint, coming from a smaller community with a steady population, I can't support it, because all I'm supporting for is to preserve my own job, but at the same time giving additional seats to Anchorage. I'm speaking now as a practical politician from my viewpoint, which I must do. So whatever you want to do, I'll simply be a do not pass, but with no hard feelings. It's just the way the game is played.
How many? Do you have a comment?
I'm a do-pass. Let me comment on Senator Ziegler's statement. I don't know if it's quite that way, because I view this as a means of providing rural areas in southeastern Alaska with the same number of representatives. And we all know it takes a certain number of people. If a very large area has just one representative, it's very difficult for that person, whomever he or she might be, to be all places and do all things. Mm-hmm. A district such as Southeast Alaska would be much more in a much more favorable position if it had several people from the Southeast area working within the legislature to promote its regional interests. True, Anchorage would gain several seats, and I think all of us are somewhat hesitant to increase the size of the legislature. But while it would benefit Anchorage, I think it would also benefit Southeast Alaska, perhaps as much or more.
On either side of the coin, I admit that. You know, I can see that.
I can see your arguments. I just can't quite buy them. I just see that great flood of people from the urban areas, that much more committee, that much, you know. I remember when we had three from Nome, they all lived together. So the idea that if you had to increase the rural, you know, you spread it around doesn't necessarily do it. I'm afraid I'm another do not pass, George.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could amend the Constitution Amendment to provide that no people could live together in the same district.
Well, you might just amend the resolution to cover the House only and leave the Senate size the way it is. Then you have one absolutely ridiculous body, because once you crack this.
Which one?
There's no way, well, there couldn't be any more ridiculous than us now, but you have for size. But once you start it, you're never going to be able to hold the size down. Every time there's a population imbalance, you'll solve it this way. And I think it's a terrible step to take.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not convinced every time there's a population imbalance you'll do it. The population of Alaska has almost doubled in the last 20 years. And you increase the size of the legislature by 27% when the population has doubled, doesn't seem to me to be very hasty action in that regard. I don't know of any other state that has had, percentage-wise, the population increase that the state of Alaska has had. And we, in fact, are falling considerably further behind what at least the framers originally visualized would be the per capita representation of the legislature. That's why.
Are you ought to read the constitutional convention, because they were estimating a population of 1.5 million to 4 million. You know, but it's going to run away. I'm sorry to see it run away, but it's going.
My experience in the legislature is that the urban guys are usually not together. They're confused. By giving them more representation, they'll probably increase that confusion. That's the only way us Bush guys can survive.
I might take objection to that, Mr. Chairman, let that be noted here.
The Bush guys survive by staying there and staying there and staying there.
So I'll support Senator Rohde's position on the building.
That's fine if the split comes the same way on the floor with the Senate.
Yeah, you'll be happy.
If we could ever get all 20 of us there, that is.
Well, he's got to have 2/3.
Oh, yes.
That's right. Within a bit of extra.
You know, you have about the same chance of that as I do with the 90-day session chance. And I consider mine much more worthwhile.
So
you were on that side too.
So your motion, Senator Rohde, is to pass
individual recommendations.
Pass out the
SGR 44 with individual recommendations.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Well, your eloquence got the bill out.
Thank you.
Which means you can.
Yes, sir.
Tell them where you got it.
Since we're on the same side,
Do we have anyone to testify on Senate Bill 324, Beverage Dispensary and Retail Liquor Licenses? We had this bill up before. It's Senator Sackett's bill.
Did they send that one back to us after we remodeled it?
No, this is
a different one.
Oh.
This is a special interest bill, one I've ever seen. I want to know who's got this store.
It probably is Smalka.
No, it's somebody in another community.
Okay.
What they're going to say is you can have swinging doors and you can sell booze in bulk in either establishment. That's what it says. Who's been inconvenienced? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Retail clerks, you know that?
I guess.
Is there any discussion on this bill, Senate Bill 324?
No, sir. I'm going to have to run. What time is it?
It's 4:07 according to Senator Rohde's clock. You got some more time?
We have Barry. 7 more minutes.
Okay.
I got a 4:00.
All right. Let's put this back then for.
I find it difficult to become enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. I, as chairman, request that we develop some enthusiasm for it, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, in that case, I would develop a little bit more.
So we'll give you a couple of days to do that, to give us a couple of days. We have then Mary Stearns, who will give us the overview on the criminal code revision bill. Committee substitute House Bill 661.
I ask what Barry's running time is supposed to be.
Barry's running time?
About 1.5 hour.
You don't mind if I up down? Mr. Chair, I'll leave 10 minutes before he's done with the exact appointment then.
I'll tough it out to the bitter end.
The clock
is running, Barry. Fire one ready.
And it's gonna be bitter.
Unfortunately, I try to go through the code in about, I guess, 20 minutes.
Oh, I like what you do on felonies.
This is Mr. Stern's presentation now.
You get your chance.
You're on his time now. So
just for the record, my name is Barry Stern. I've been staff counsel to the Criminal Code Commission and Subcommission for the past two years. I thought I'd try to give an overview of the Criminal Code, and to do so, I guess the most important concept is that we classify offenses into a very limited number of categories. The main category of things in the code is called offenses, and that's consisted of crimes and violations. a crime is punishable by imprisonment or a fine, whereas a violation is only punishable by a maximum $300 fine. There are very few violations in the code. Best example would be littering, just punishable by fine. Crimes are split into felonies and misdemeanors. Traditional distinction. If a felony is anything where you may be in prison for more than 1 year, misdemeanor is imprisonment up to 1 year. Felonies are in turn divided into five classes. First one is murder in the first degree, class by itself with its own punishment category. Second one is murder in the second degree and kidnapping in the first degree. Okay, those are by themselves. They're really unclassified crimes. The rest of the felonies are divided into A, B, and C felonies. A, of course, being the most serious, and include rape, armed robbery, aggravated assault. The most of the felonies in the code are C felonies. That's the greatest amount of felonies in the code. Misdemeanors are divided into two categories, A and B. A misdemeanors would be a maximum 1 year imprisonment. B misdemeanors would be 90-day maximum. So again, all the offenses in the code are broken into crimes, violations, and felonies, misdemeanors, and these are the main categories, A, B, and C for felonies, and A, B for misdemeanors. And this scheme here, the A, B, and C, and the A and B, that determines basically what the sentence will be. And, that's the final section of the code, the sentencing procedures. The important thing is that all eight felonies are treated the same for sentencing purposes, whereas under existing law, you have a separate penalty for each crime. Now, this is an outline of the code, and I'm trying to go rather quickly on it. And the code is broken up into, The code is broken up into, I believe, approximately 8 or 10 chapters, and some of the chapters are in turn broken into articles. Chapter 16 is the first chapter of the code, and it's parties to crime. And that deals with general principles of accomplice liability, also when it's an organization wanted for crime. Chapter 31 deals with attempt and solicitation for incohate crimes. Does not have a conspiracy statute. The original bill did have a conspiracy statute and was taken out by the House Judiciary Committee. Chapter 41 is offenses against the person. This is probably the most important section of the code in terms of the crimes. It's divided into five articles. Homicide, assault, kidnapping, sexual offenses, and robbery. In the criminal homicide article, we have murder in the first degree, murder in the second degree, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide. Assault contains 3 degrees of assault plus the crime of reckless endangerment. Kidnapping contains 2 degrees of kidnapping, 2 degrees of custodial interference, and a provision on unlawful imprisonment. The sexual offenses article contains 3 degrees of sexual assault. The first degree is being basically rape. We don't call it rape, we call it sexual assault in the first degree. Sexual assault in the second degree is felony sexual contact. And third degree involves sexual penetration or sexual contact with people who may be mentally incapacitated or otherwise defective. The robbery article just contains the robbery statutes, which are divided into 2 degrees, basically in terms of whether the defendant was armed or not. Chapter 46 is offenses against property. Contains 5 articles. Theft is the major one. The most important thing in the theft statute is that we have a consolidated theft provision, which combines, I think, into one statute, which is divided into 3 degrees, approximately 20 or 30 provisions in existing law. We have a burglary and criminal trespass article, arson and criminal mischief, forgery, business and commercial offenses. Chapter 51 is offenses against the family. I'm going to get done a lot earlier than I have done more. Offenses against the family, and that contains provisions on contributing, bigamy, unlawful exploitation. No, I guess not. Bigamy, endangering the welfare of a minor, which would be similar to child abandonment. Chapter 56 is offenses against public administration. You have your provisions there on bribery, perjury, escape, interference with judicial proceedings,
obstruction of public administration, and abuse of public office.
They don't do much to us for that.
I believe his name, Mr. Mayor. Chapter 61 is offenses against public order. And what we have there is riot, disorderly conduct. One provision which was quite amusing, at least in House Judiciary, was the use of a corpse.
That's funny.
Leave some statute on harassment. Chapter 66 is a fairly sexy title. It's called Offenses Against Public Health and Decency. And that has prostitution and gambling.
Well, what does the solicitation on the other one come from? That's strictly.
You mean the general solicitation statute?
Yeah.
Well, with prostitution, and we had it's an interesting result. We have a general solicitation statute that says if you solicit a crime and it's not committed, you're punished one degree below the actual offense. So if you solicit a crime, for example, rape, and it's never committed, you would be punishable as a B felony. With prostitution, the committee felt that the solicitation of prostitution in public should be treated more seriously than the act of prostitution.
Solicitation by whom?
By either
me or her.
He or her.
Okay. In other words, if it's in a house, it's not very serious, while if it's on the street where you're pestering the public, it is serious.
That's correct. I should point out that it differs from the commission's recommendation. The commission's recommendation said that any form of solicitation, regardless of whether it was in public or private, should be an A misdemeanor. The committee changed that and said it would have to be public.
You have to defend your massage parlor.
I beg your pardon.
Well, after all,
you don't have to do anything.
You represent.
Gambling, I think the most important change in the gambling, well, there are two important changes in the gambling statute. Number one is we made an attempt, I think successfully, to allow for, quote, friendly poker games, to exclude that from the coverage of the criminal law. Additionally, we attempted to deal with large-scale gambling enterprises by making a felony gambling statute that's patterned after federal law. But that is a significant change from existing law. Under existing law, there would be no felony provisions for gambling. Weapons and explosives contains provisions on carrying concealed weapons, possession by felons. It contains also provisions on possession of burglary tools and possession of explosives with intent to commit crime. Chapter 76 is miscellaneous offenses, and it is miscellaneous. We have a provision on giving tobacco to minors, provision on interference with constitutional rights, and a provision on transportation of depictions of minors engaged in prohibited sexual acts. That provision was added by the House Judiciary Committee in attempts to deal with the selling of child porno. There's, I feel, from a constitutional standpoint, there may be some substantial problem with that. Chapter 81 is the general provision section of the code. That's dealing with the general purposes of the code, the applicability of the code, how offenses are classified, general principles of justification, which attempt to deal with the problem of how much force you can use in self-defense, how much force can be used by a peace officer making an arrest, how much force can be used to prevent a burglary. Those are rather emotional topics, and it did get a fair amount of discussion in House Judiciary, but that's where those are found. Article 5 deals with responsibility, which is the insanity statute. Article 6 deals with general principles of criminal liability, and that section is probably one of the most important sections of the code. In that section, we attempt to define the four mens rea terms, or the four culpable mental states in the code. And the four terms are intentional, knowing, reckless, and criminal negligence. And those are the only four terms used in the code to denote mens rea. And existing law, there's probably 30 or so terms that are used. We try to have uniformity. The important thing, I guess, on this culpability provision is, it's new to existing law in the sense that you have four specific terms, but it's very common to other states. I think I was just
doing some research before the meeting, and now there are 34 states that have revised criminal codes, and maybe with one or two exceptions, all of those states use those four terms, and they have common definitions.
What, through the chair, what standard for competency did you use?
As the test. Competency to stand trial?
Yes.
We did not deal with that exception.
You did not?
Yes. We, since that was in Title 12, and it did not deal with the actual issue of insanity in terms of criminal responsibility, we did not even touch it. The existing statute would remain in Title 12. Okay. We never looked at it. And then you have your definitions. There are probably 52, I think, definitions in the code, and one thing that has bothered at least specifically police officers is that they have to look in the back of the code to find out what the definitions are for sections that appear on page 2. Legislative error says it has to be that way. But we do have definitions that are used throughout, and they are defined in the back. Now, after Chapter 81, we have our Title 12 provisions, which are sentencing. We made a decision to deal with all sentencing procedures separately from the substantive provisions and keep those provisions in Title 12. The sentencing sections are divided, they're not really in articles, but for purposes of the presentation, I divided them into 9 sections. The first deals with sentencing procedures, and that deals with such matters as a sentencing report, does a 2 sentences run concurrently or consecutively. The second provision deals with fines for an offense. For example, if you commit a felony, I believe the fine is $50,000, regardless of whether it's an A, B, or C felony. It sets out the fines for misdemeanors and also for an organization convicted of a crime. Then we have a provision on restitution. We have provision on community work service. In other words, the judge for first offense fails to order the person convicted to clean up the litter on the streets, for example, or perhaps do some tutoring in school. That was discussed by the committee. The fifth article, the fifth section, is the most important, and that's the imprisonment terms. And I'll go into some detail on that in a second. Next section deals with how do you determine a prior conviction for purposes of enhancement of sentences. And that's really important because under the code, if you're a repeat felon, you're going to be subject to presumptive sentencing. And so the determination of what constitutes a prior offense is set out in the code. Finally, we have, getting there again, we have specific listings of mitigating and aggravating factors. And again, this is really important too, because for purposes of repeat felons, the code says you must serve a specific term of years. For example, 10 years for a second A felony. Now that term can be lowered or aggravated by 50% depending on the presence of these various mitigating or aggravating factors. The next to the last section deals with the 3-judge panel. And this deals with the extraordinary case in presumptive sentencing, where even though the bill says it should be 5 years, the circumstances are so extraordinary that the person should either get more than 5 or should get much less than 5. And in those situations, the bill says you have to give it to a 3-judge panel who does the sentencing. Finally, we have our provisions on parole and good time. And the parole provision is really an amendment of existing law, and what it says is that parole is not eligible. People who are second and third felon offenders are not eligible for parole. They serve their time. And then we have a provision on good time, which says all people incarcerated, I believe for felonies, are entitled to 1 day good time for every 3 days served. And that's really the only out for a repeat felon. No parole, but 1 day for every 3 days served. And this is the final little chart here. And this is to kind of get you familiar with presumptive sentencing. The issue of whether to apply presumptive sentencing to first felons was probably the most debated issue of the sentencing provisions. The commission, the Criminal Code Subcommission, made an initial determination that as to first-time offenders in the felony class, you would not have presumptive sentencing. The judge would have total discretion as to sentences. However, for second and third
of offenders, there is a system of presumptive sentencing. Now, what this does here is we have A, B, and C felonies, and it's important to note that presumptive sentencing does not apply to misdemeanors. Misdemeanors are governed exactly as they are today. If it's an A misdemeanor, it's 0 to 1 year. If it's a B misdemeanor, it's 0 to 90 days, regardless of whether it's your second offense. So for your first offenses, you have maximum terms of imprisonment. For an A felony, it's 22 and a half years. I should point out that until, I think, the second or third day before the bill was sent to the floor, this number used to be 15 and was raised to 22 and a half. But for the first A felony, it was 22 and a half. For a first B felony, it's 7. For a first C felony, it's 3. And again, the judge doesn't have to give that, but if he is going to give jail time, it cannot exceed that maximum. Probation is available, suspended imposition of sentence is available. If you're a first-time felon offender, you will also be eligible for parole, as under the existing system. Now, when you're dealing for a second offender, you have presumptive sentencing. And the important thing is to determine what is a second offender. Under the commission's proposal, in order to be a second offender, you would have had to previously be convicted of the same or higher class of crime. So, if you are now being sentenced for a B felony, and your previous offense was a C felony, you would not be a second offender. Now, that was under the commission's proposal. Now, this was changed by House Judiciary Committee. And what House Judiciary Committee said is that any previous felony would get you into the felony second offender category. So let's assume we're dealing here with a guy with an offender who had a C felony and now he's being sentenced for an A. His presumptive sentence is 10 years. That would also apply if he had previously been convicted of an A felony. There's no distinction between the two. Now, that 10-year sentence could be aggravated 50%, which would go up to 15, or mitigated to 5. And then here are the numbers for second Bs, which would be 5, then 2. Third would be 15, 10, 4. And again, the 50% factor would apply to the second and the third. Okay. Now, the only exception to this scheme are the unclassified crimes and the firearm provision for A felonies. For murder in the first degree, the sentence has to be 20 to 99 years, and the 20-year sentence is a mandatory minimum sentence that must be served. For murder in the second degree or kidnapping, there's a 5 to 99-year sentence. Again, the 5-year sentence is a mandatory minimum sentence. And then, this amendment came also fairly late in the game. The House Judiciary Committee added a provision which said that if you are being sentenced as a first-time A felon, and again, we're talking about crimes like rape, armed robbery, aggravated assault, and you had committed the offense with a firearm, you must be sentenced to a 3-year minimum sentence. So that is these provisions are really the only mandatory minimum sentences in the bill. And again, summary, no parole for second and third offenders, and also no probation or SIS for second and thirds. Good time is 1 to 3. And that's, I guess, 20 minutes.
Very well done. Mr. Chairman.
Senator, sir.
With the exception of the last sheet, I'm wondering if Barry could lend that to Debbie or whoever for a couple of days to prepare an informal index so that we can have section and page number and titles thrown in our folders. We're going to be into this thing hot and heavy for the next couple of weeks at least. And if you could just bat us out an index as to what he's just been covering based upon that chart, that would be a big help if we all had one, because we can go just to page and section to section for cross references and everything else.
If you could just type off the
Off the first couple of the first, all the pages but the last one.
Would you want it it doesn't break it down in terms of the specific crimes?
No, just okay. What you've got, just your basic outline, because when you're guiding us through this thing, you can say, now here we're on page 42, but you should check this out against page 76 and this other for correlation purposes. It'd make it a lot easier for us.
Tell me what you're working on now. What were you?
Okay, I'm working on off the bill that passed the House.
We got the House.
No, I know that. But my question, let me ask you again. You're compiling some information in the document, right?
I'm sorry.
What was the suggestion, Doug?
Oh, policy changes.
I suggested that Barry compile a memo that laid out very succinctly all the policy changes in the code of the present law. I'm sure Senator Ziegler would know those anyway, but maybe some of the other members of the Senate wouldn't. Mm-hmm.
I thought if your schedule is just go to specific sections of the code, I thought instead of giving you one major one, I would do some separate ones for each day you would take up a section. For example, if you did offense against a person, I hope to give you a handout 2 days before that, before the meeting, as opposed to just a general one. But I could probably run it all off. It doesn't really matter.
Have you seen, within recent days, a letter written by an Andrew Klein from the Tanana Valley Bar Association?
No, I haven't.
If you have time, drop by my office tomorrow. Let me run a copy up. He's got some good, not real hard criticisms, but he raises some interesting points.
Senator, I'm not certain of the procedure on this, but in terms of the index, are we working with the committee substitute that passed the House?
The House form, yeah.
Okay.
I move with her.
Okay, your needle wiggles? Okay. I'll call the meeting to order. It's Senate Judiciary, April the 25th. Present for the purpose of quorum are Senators Ziegler, Tillian, and Homan. Barry, are you ready to?
Yes.
Okay. State your name and proceed.
For the record, my name is Barry Stern. I was the staff counsel for the Criminal Code Subcommittee. I prepared two handouts that should be in your folders. One is just basically an index to the code. The other is entitled Senate Judiciary Committee Meeting 42578 and outlines the major policy changes in the revised code with existing law. What I would like to do is use the chart again and go through the crimes against the person. Today. This is chapter 41 of the bill. And that begins, I believe, on
page 6.
The homicide article is the first article of the chapter 41, and there are four crimes contained in that section. We have 2 degrees of murder, we have manslaughter, and we have criminally negligent homicide. Now, just for some background, the original proposal by the subcommission only had 1 degree of murder. And it was defined to include conduct described in murder in the first and murder in the second degree. So the House Judiciary Committee felt that we should have 2 degrees, and we did create 2 degrees in House Judiciary. Murder in the first degree is defined as an intentional killing. And that is the only type of conduct covered within that statute. I pointed out on the that list of policy changes that there is no requirement that the killing be done with deliberate and premeditated malice. It's just solely an intentional killing would be first-degree murder. Second-degree murder, first-degree murder, by the way, carries a 20 to 99-year sentence. The 20-year sentence is a minimum sentence that has to be given.
Mr. Chairman, question.
Senators,
are we free to interrupt Barry from time to time if a question occurs?
Do you
object to that?
No, I don't.
In other words, the split-second reaction, the picking up of a rifle and shooting, would be first-degree murder.
That is correct. That is correct. There has to be a conscious objective to cause death. I would also think that under existing law, as long as there would be some time to think about it, even though it was a split-second thought, it would possibly still be first-degree murder.
You know, it's contradistinguished from lying in wait, bushwhacking, or ambushing somebody, okay?
Mm-hmm. The problem with the existing formulation of premeditated malice, it really doesn't require lying in wait. If it did, it may have a valid distinction, but it doesn't. So first degree murder is the intentional killing, and it's a 20-year minimum sentence, and it goes as high as 99 years. Now, second degree is three forms of conduct. The first is intent to cause serious physical injury, or knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death or serious physical injury, you cause death. And that's just a shade below first degree murder, and it's questionable whether that's really an appropriate distinction between the two. But I think that it is, to some extent. To the point that it includes intent to cause serious physical injury as necessary culpable mental state for murder, that would expand existing law. Under existing law, if you just merely intended to cause serious physical injury and death resulted, you'd probably be guilty of manslaughter at the most. Subsection A2 covers conduct which I like to refer to as depraved heart murder. That's conduct where you don't necessarily intend to kill, but your act was so reckless that it deserves the punishment provided for under the murder statute. And that is defined as intentionally performing an act resulting in death under circumstances manifesting extreme difference in the value of human life. Now, the kind of conduct that would be covered by that is perhaps throwing rocks off a building into a crowded street, or racing your motorboat through some swimmers. It's hard to say whether that conduct is covered under murder in either degree under existing law. There's one in the policy discussion I handed out. There's one statute called obstructing or injuring railroad or aircraft, which says that if you basically put an obstruction in front of a railroad and someone dies, even though you didn't intend to cause death, you're guilty of first degree murder.
Good.
Now, this would apply to all acts that are that type of conduct, regardless of whether it was a steamship or a ferry or something like that. Now, subsection A3 is a felony murder, and that is also new to existing law. The felony murder rule would hold a felon liable for basically all deaths occurring during certain violent felonies. And we have a very limited felony murder rule under existing law, and essentially we don't have any, according to the Supreme Court's interpretation in Gray. Now, murder in the second degree carries a 5 to 99-year sentence, with 5 years being a mandatory minimum sentence. The next section in the code sets out the defenses to murder. The first one is the defense of heat of passion, and that applies to the intentional killings. And that is set out on page 7 of the bill. And that's basically your common law defense of heat of passion. And what it does, it says if you kill in a heat of passion and it falls within the description of what a heat of passion is, it won't be murder, it'll be manslaughter. And that's existing law. The second defense says that if you aid a suicide, it is not murder, it is it's going to be manslaughter. And that's similar to existing law. It's called, in existing law, there's a separate statute called procuring a suicide. The important thing to note, however, is that this refers to aiding a suicide. For example, someone, your wife may tell you to go out and buy some poison so she can commit suicide. If you, for example, are requested to pull a trigger so the person can die, that's not seen as a suicide in the code, although it's not specifically specified. That would be first degree murder. Subsection B1 and B2 apply simply to felony murder, and there are two very limited defenses to felony murder. The first one in subsection B1 is, just for purposes of the discussion, I call the good felon defense, and that deals with the situation where the person that is committing the felony isn't armed with a deadly weapon or dangerous instrument. He doesn't have any reason to believe that anyone else is armed, and he had no reasonable ground to believe that anyone was going to engage in conduct where death would likely result. The kind of conduct that would be covered by that is a situation where a person goes into to hold up a grocery store, and he's not armed with a deadly weapon, and he doesn't produce a deadly weapon, doesn't make representations that the deadly weapon is there. a guard shoots at the felon and misses the felon, kills a bystander. This provision says that the felon is not guilty of felony murder. He could be charged with something else. He could be charged perhaps with manslaughter, but it's not a felony murder. It's a very limited defense.
But if he's armed.
If he's armed.
He has the firearm.
That's correct. If he's armed with a dangerous instrument, he is going to be guilty of felony murder because he would not meet the requirement to be.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Now, subsection 2, it's really a very difficult provision to explain. And just speaking with Mr. Hickey beforehand, it might need some redrafting to make it clearer. This provision deals with the situation. Well, let me backtrack. One of the crimes that is sufficient for felony murder is burglary in the first degree. Burglary in the first degree in part is defined as burglary into a dwelling. Now, consider the situation where a person intends to kill someone, and in order to accomplish that task, he has to unlawfully enter a building, unlawfully enter the dwelling. This simply says that if that is that type of situation, you shouldn't be charged with felony murder. You should be charged with intentional killing, with intentional murder, or knowing murder, just not felony murder. It's a very limited defense, and it's basically telling the prosecutor in that type of situation, don't charge with felony murder, charge with intentional murder. Subsection C deals with the situation where the person may have acted based on some justification, but it turned out that his belief was unreasonable. For example, under the code, if you kill someone in self-defense and the jury finds that it's a reasonable belief that it was necessary to do that, you won't be guilty of any crime. This provision says if you kill someone in self-defense and it's an unreasonable belief, but it's an honest belief nonetheless, you would not be guilty of murder, you would be guilty of manslaughter. This would also apply, for example, to the police officer who is making an arrest and he unreasonably believes he may use deadly force. Turns out that he could not, but he honestly believed that. This says you're not guilty of murder, you're guilty of manslaughter. This would be similar to existing law too. Now, the next crime is manslaughter. And manslaughter is defined as the intentional, knowing, or reckless killing not amounting to murder. What this really covers is killing in the heat of passion, an unreasonable belief as justification, aiding a suicide, and also reckless killing. And that's similar to our existing manslaughter statute. The final crime in the homicide section is criminally negligent homicide. And on that policy sheet, I pointed out that this is new to existing law, and I put a question mark next to it. I say it really isn't, but most everyone else I've spoken to says that it is. So let's assume that it is new to existing law. Now, what this requires, criminally negligent homicide, is a criminally negligently causing death. And the term criminal negligence is defined on page 94. That definition basically requires that the person disregard, I'm sorry, probably best just to turn to it. Criminal negligence in terms of causing death is defined as a person failing to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that death will occur. And the risk must be of such a nature and degree that failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. First of all, this is not ordinary negligence. It has to be a gross deviation, and it has to be of such a nature and degree that failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe. And the commentary stresses it's not ordinary negligence, but it deals with the situation where you should have been aware of a risk of death, and you weren't, and was extremely culpable. And under the code, the jury finds that you did act criminally negligently and death resulted, it would be a C felony.
Where's that definition that you referred to?
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's on page 94.
Bottom of 94,
line 28. See, it's probably good to emphasize the distinction between recklessly and criminal negligence.
In the code, we have four terms that we use to denote culpability: intentional, knowing, reckless, and criminal negligence. Now, recklessness is defined as awareness and disregard of the risk. So for your manslaughter case, the person would be aware of a risk of death and then disregard it. For criminal negligence, he wouldn't be aware of the risk, and he disregarded it unconsciously.
But he should have been aware.
He should have been aware. That's correct. And most, I believe every revised code which I've consulted does recognize the concept of criminal negligence as a sufficient culpability standard for homicides and certain assaults. But outside of the homicide and assault area, I think we only use the term criminal negligence in one other statute. It's the lowest form of culpability. That's homicide.
Questions on this, or do we go on?
No, I don't. I have no trouble with what you're doing so far.
Okay. Assault. I'll try to point out before I begin each section the changes from the original draft. When we came in from the subcommission to the House Judiciary Committee, we had four degrees of assault, plus the crime of reckless endangerment, plus the crime of simple assault. It was felt that that was just too much, that we tried differentiating assaults. We went a little too far. So what we ended up doing in House Judiciary was that we compressed four degrees of assault into three, and the crime of simple assault was totally eliminated from the assault sections and treated as harassment, which we'll come to, I think, tomorrow. Now, there are three factors that distinguish the various forms of assault in the code. The first is the culpability of the defendant. And what that basically says is that the person that acts intentionally is going to be held guilty of a higher crime, usually, than the person that acted recklessly or with criminal negligence. The second way the assaults are distinguished is in terms of the type of injury that is inflicted. And we distinguish between two types: physical injury and serious physical injury. Assaults that produce serious physical injury are generally treated more seriously than assaults that produce physical injury or assaults that merely place a person in fear of injury. The final way we distinguish between the assaults is the was whether a weapon was used in committing the offense. And generally, if a weapon was used, it's going to be treated as a more serious form of assault. Assault in the first degree is an A felony, and it describes three forms of conduct. The first is similar to the assault with a dangerous weapon statute, and it provides that when you cause physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, intending to cause serious physical injury, you're guilty of the first degree assault, which is an A felony. Now, the term serious physical injury, and dangerous instrument are all defined in the definition section of the bill. Serious physical injury is defined on page 101, and it's physical injury which creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious and protracted disfigurement, protracted impairment of health, or protracted impairment of the function of a bodily organ, or physical injury which unlawfully terminates a pregnancy. Physical injury is just defined as physical pain or impairment of physical condition. A dangerous instrument is defined as anything which, under the circumstances, used, attempted to be used, threatened to be used, is capable of causing death or serious physical injury. So, you know, this coffee cup could be a dangerous instrument if I picked it up and started hitting someone over the head with it. And the definition of dangerous instrument specifically includes firearms, and firearms are defined to include loaded as well as unloaded firearms. Subsection A2 is similar to the mayhem statute in existing law, and it prohibits the conduct of causing serious physical injury when you acted with the intent of causing such injury. So it's defined with the intent to cause serious physical injury, cause physical injury. Subsection A3 is similar to that provision of the murder in the second degree statute, which I refer to as depraved heart murder. This says that if you intentionally performing an act that causes serious physical injury under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, you're guilty of an A felony. So under the code, if you throw the rock off the building and someone dies, you're going to be guilty of second-degree murder. If someone doesn't die but he's seriously injured, you're going to be guilty of assault in the first degree, which is going to be an A felony. Assault in the second degree is defined in three subsections. The first is defined as with intent to cause physical injury, you cause serious physical injury. The second is intentionally placing a person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. Now, that doesn't require that any injury occur. It simply requires placing the person in fear. And because dangerous instrument is defined as including firearms that are loaded as well as unloaded, merely pointing an unloaded firearm at someone would be assault in the second degree. So when you're dealing with your firearm type of assaults, you're going to either charge under subsection A1 of the first degree section if there is some type of injury, or you're going to charge under subsection A2 if there's no injury, as long as you prove an intent to place the person in fear of imminent serious physical injury. Subsection A3 is defined as recklessly causing physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument. That might be the situation where you swing a club around over your head and it just goes flying off and it knocks someone out. That's defined as a B felony. And again, the definition of reckless requires a gross deviation from the standard of cure. So it's fairly serious conduct. So those are the first two degrees of assault, and they're both felonies. Assault in the third degree is your basic form of assault in the code. It's defined as intentionally or recklessly causing physical injury or causing physical injury by a dangerous instrument if you acted with criminal negligence or placing a person in fear of imminent physical injury. And this section, B3, it's A3, is the lesser included of subsection A2. In the sense that if you place the person in fear of imminent serious physical injury by means of a dangerous instrument, it's going to be a B felony. If you didn't use a dangerous instrument, if you just simply used your hands or by words, you're going to be guilty of any misdemeanor.
You mean verbal assault?
That is correct. I believe it's defined as by words or conduct.
That's what it says.
Yes.
Well, I mean, suppose somebody says, and looks as if he means to do it, you son of a bitch, I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You mean he could be prosecuted?
Well, I should point out,
sorry, we'd be buried if I'm
not. I think it requires that you be frightened by that. If you're not frightened, yes, then he's clear.
and that's
happened to me three times today. Oh, my God, I've been scared every time.
Does this apply to caucuses?
There's a special exemption for conduct during the session. Actually, Senator Ziegler, the way the statute was drafted previously, on page 10, line 14, it said, by word or conduct, he intentionally places or attempts to place, and would cover unsuccessful attempts. And House Judiciary thought that was just too broad, and we just simply kept the requirement that you actually succeed in doing it. And I think the limitation to imminent physical injury, I think, may go a fair amount to making the statute not as broad as it could be if we didn't have the imminent in there.
There are two, what would you call them, two variables, right? Whether he intentionally places, intentional, and fear, right? If the guy's not frightened by it. Mm-hmm. Or he could always, his defense is he didn't mean to do it, right?
Well,
mean to do it.
Yeah, well, under intentionally, the definition of intentionally, you would have to prove that it was his conscious objective to place a person in fear. And that's going to be, you're never going to be able to prove that by pointing to specific facts. It's going to always have to be circumstantial. And it's going to be, I think, a fairly serious case before you charge someone with that deception. The final crime in this article is called reckless endangerment. And this is new to existing law. reckless endangerment covers the conduct of recklessly engaging in conduct which creates a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. The important thing to note about this statute is, number one, there doesn't have to be any injury to anyone. You didn't have to intend to cause injury, simply creating a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. One example that person just recently gave me about conduct which would be covered under this was apparently a few years in Juneau, someone walked into the Baranoff, and I'm sorry, not the Baranoff, the Red Dog, and pulled out a chainsaw and started swinging it every which way. And I think that under this statute, you could say that he engaged in conduct which created a substantial risk of serious physical injury to another person. Under existing law, we have statutes on careless use of firearms. We have it on negligent and reckless driving, which cover this kind of conduct as those specific types of conduct. This is a general provision and would apply to all forms of conduct that fit within the definition. It's a fairly typical provision in revised criminal codes, and I know particularly people in the field of law enforcement think it's a fairly decent thing. I'm going to just have to take a little break, just get some water.
Thank you.
Gotcha.
When it comes to this...
What are the penalties for...
What page are we on now?
Dan knows that it's defined in the code.
An A misdemeanor?
Yeah, an A misdemeanor is up to a year. A B misdemeanor is up to, what, 30 days?
90 days.
90 days. Should I move on to kidnapping?
What's 90 days? Tell me it again now.
A misdemeanor would have a maximum sentence of 1 year. A B misdemeanor would have a maximum sentence of 90 days. And those, all misdemeanors, are totally within the judge's discretion. No
mandatory sentencing at all, no presumptive sentencing.
That's right.
It's not a bad code. There's a couple little things I want to change. Like firearm.
The guy that walked into the Red Dog the other night and hit the waitress, now what, where would he fall in this?
Was he married to her? We can't allow this spouse.
Okay. First of all, was he armed with a gun or
no? Just hit her.
Just hit her. And that would be under the A misdemeanor offense. Intentionally causes physical injury to another person under
A1.
Yeah, A1.
Okay. And he could get then up to a year, right?
That's correct. Under existing law, it would only be a maximum of 6 months under the general assault statute.
Under existing law, somebody has to press charges?
Under existing law, and I think under both.
Under this law, too.
This one, too, you have to press charges. If you let somebody pound on you, it's legal.
Without a complaint or an indictment, there is no prosecution.
You're talking about a misdemeanor.
Then the person who who's injured, under existing law, it's required that that person file charges.
Well, I think Dan could probably answer this a little better, but the thing is if it's a misdemeanor assault, there's a requirement that in order to make an arrest to take place within the presence of the officer. So that might go to the reason why you need someone to file charges, but Dan could probably answer better.
There's a difference procedurally, Senator, between proceeding with an arrest and proceeding with the filing of a charge in court, accusing someone of doing something. In order to arrest an individual for a misdemeanor offense, a police officer has to have observed the offense himself or have a third party make a citizen's arrest. With the exception of Envoy under present law and under the proposed code, there's a proposal to allow for probable cause arrest not committed in the presence of the arresting officer in domestic situations, assault on the spouse. In order to file charges, all I would have to have is a report that provided me with evidence of an offense, and whether the person who was the victim technically wanted to go forward with the case or not would be irrelevant. If I made a determination that the public interest was such that the case should go forward and the person should be forced to testify who was the victim, then technically the defendant could still be prosecuted.
Okay, now did the person that suffers the injury, does she's a waitress, does she have to
I guess if he heard about it, or the policeman heard about it, he could just press charges.
In other words, if someone called the police and he came, and the police officer came and she said, yes, he assaulted me in the Red Dog, he came in and punched me in the mouth, but I don't want to sign a citizen's arrest, then the police officer couldn't arrest the man. But he could take statements from everybody who was a witness, and then he could bring a report to one of my offices, and it would describe what occurred and who observed what. On that basis, I could file a charge accusing the defendant of having hit that woman in the mouth. Now, the woman may subsequently come forward and say, gee, I really don't want to go forward with this. I don't want to testify against this person. I'd like you to drop it. And we may or may not.
Is the guy walking the streets while all this is happening?
He would be until I filed a charge and got either a summons or a warrant. I could file a charge and ask the judge for a warrant, in which case then the police officer could go arrest him.
Yeah, we're talking about some time, though, right?
Sure.
Then they argue about bail, if any.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he'd be right out on bail on misdemeanor and something like that.
Sure.
There's any way to do it unless he's criminally dangerous, like if he was drunk, waving, and threatening somebody else, then I guess you could lock him up. But otherwise,
who was the waitress?
Little Lolly.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, she quit, right? She didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of business anymore after that. Can't blame her. But no. It seems to me that Clara was there, and the officer said that, I don't know if she didn't, if it was because she didn't see the actual blow being delivered or what, but she couldn't, they wouldn't arrest the fellow anyway. And I understand that
quite often the person hit doesn't see it coming. That's a fine one. How do you press charges? You know.
It would take someone who observed the offense to make a citizen's arrest and sign a little form for the police officer saying, I observed such and such. The person